This podcast is supported by Australian Ethical. Australian Ethical grow your retirement savings without sacrificing integrity for performance, so you can build a better future for yourself and our world. Because when your super prospers, we all thrive. Please read the FSG, PDS and TMD on the website to consider if the product is right for you and the ethical guide to understand how they invest. Issued by Australian Ethical Superannuation Proprietary Limited, AFSL 526055.
Hi, Nino. Welcome back. It's good to see you again.
You too, Ajit.
Nino, Desi Freeman is still missing since August now. How hard is it for someone in this day and age to disappear for so long?
Look, it's equal parts hard and not particularly difficult at all when you consider where he was when he was last seen. So, you know, you've got to remember this is a guy who was literally living on the boundary of a national park that has some of the densest sort of bushland in Victoria.
And is a vast area.
A vast area, you know, and he fled in a hail of gunfire into that area and was, from what we've sort of been able to glean in our reporting, was effectively allowed quite a head start into that space. And, you know, the other fascinating thing about this case is who Desi Freeman was. You know, it's not you or I, you know, running off into that bush. This is a guy who knew that land almost as well as anybody. This was his playground. And what that obviously then lends itself to is that, you know, if anyone was going to be able to get into that space and disappear and not be found again, it's someone like him.
We're going to get into the latest police theories about where he could be and where the search is at. But before we go there, I want to ask you about your trip to Porepunkha, because you were there talking to locals, getting a sense of what things are like. How are people feeling? What have they told you?
Yeah, I think there's definitely still a wariness there and still a kind of unease. The thing that kind of struck me is that it is such a beautiful part of the world, and that it is not necessarily remote, but it backs onto such remote country and such wild country. And that's the appeal of places like Porepunkha and the high country to people. But when something like this happens, that sort of takes on a bit of a sinister air, that beauty and that wilderness and that sort of almost vast expanse of countryside, all of a sudden that becomes a little bit frightening, you know, and there is a little bit of a sense of that no longer being a sanctuary, but actually being something to be concerned about. And that was something that I kind of found quite fascinating. And, you know, it was Mount Buffalo National Park that Freeman fled into. You can't avoid Mount Buffalo. You know, if you're driving in that area, you can see it from everywhere because of how huge it is. And that sort of struck me as something that would be quite difficult. You know, if you're living in that part of the world and you 3 months on know that Desi Freeman's still at large, you're sort of constantly reminded of where he was last seen and of that awful tragedy.
And what was it like to be at the scene of the shooting as well?
Yeah, I mean, we can't get to the scene of where the actual shooting happened. You know, that's behind a locked gate into that property. But certainly talking to people nearby, that's their psyche, that sort of sense almost of kind of, without being overly dramatic, kind of wilderness lost in a way, you know, that this kind of untainted, unspoiled, beautiful bushland now potentially is, you know, harboring someone who committed these awful shootings. So there was a heaviness over that place, I think you could say, even though the actual police presence is certainly not what it was in the first sort of weeks after the search. There's not as many visible reminders, I guess, of what's actually going on and what happened, but there's definitely an uneasiness.
And what about how some of the people are feeling who knew one of the officers who died? I believe he was a core part of the town and quite well known.
Detective Senior Constable Neil Thompson was a really well known police officer up that way. There was some people actually lived close to Freeman who I spoke to when I was up doing the reporting for this trip. And, you know, they sat down and were generous enough to kind of share probably an hour with us kind of sitting outside their property, which also backs onto the national park, and were talking about their experience of the whole incident, but also being being close to Thompson, or Tomo as they called him, and he was supposed to come around for a coffee at their place the day of the incident. He sort of called a friend of one of theirs and said, hey, you know, I might stop by for a coffee later on. I got to do some work up there this morning, but after I finish that job, I'll come by. And obviously never came. It was really fascinating sitting down and speaking to them, because it was clear as we were having that conversation that this couple hadn't actually really discussed between each other some of the ways they were feeling and some of the ways this had affected them. It was almost kind of because we were there, because there was someone else there, it gave them an opportunity to talk in a little bit more of a kind of frank way about how it had affected them than they'd necessarily done between themselves. And that was really revealing, but also, you know, difficult to hear, because you did get a sense of the fact that this really precious property that they had and this really, I guess, wonderful experience they had living in such a kind of untouched place, that wasn't the same for them anymore because of what had gone on just down the road.
You have experience reporting on notorious manhunts. You wrote a book about a very different case. So I wonder in this instance what police are telling you about why they haven't been able to find Desi Freeman.
Police aren't saying a great deal about the why. What they're saying is that there's three possible scenarios here about what's happened. And, you know, the first one is that Freeman is still in the area, he's still alive, and that he's being harboured by people effectively, or helped by people. They think that's the least remote of the three scenarios. The second scenario is that he's died and that they just haven't recovered, you know, his remains or any sort of trace of him. And the third scenario is that he is alive, but that he's out of the area, that he's managed to get somewhere else. And, you know, that's obviously not impossible. You know, while this countryside is particularly remote and it is dense bushland, if you can make a head start and you can get out of there, there's roads that can take you all across the countryside pretty quickly. There were various bits and pieces of information I heard when I was up there that made me kind of think, actually, you know what? Like, it wouldn't have been that difficult for him to slip out despite the net kind of closing at that particular period of time, if he'd managed to get through the bush. That's obviously a big if. And the thing that's staggering about this, obviously, is that there's not been a single trace of him since that moment that he left into the bush after the shooting. There's not been a single thing police have said, no confirmed sighting. So we're really dealing with a ghost here. There's nothing publicly, at least, that police have said that gives any indication at all about what's happened to Desi Freeman.
That's extraordinary, given it was described as the largest ever tactical policing operation. You know, hundreds of officers were in the area, $1 million reward for information.
I think the thing that I've come to realise here is that while that is true, there are also these quite obvious restrictions on how they conducted that manhunt in the very early days. The main one being the real threat of other police officers being harmed or killed by Freeman if they, you know, went off into the bush after him straight away. So, you know, speaking to people down there and speaking to other people who are involved in this, it's clear that there was a 2 or 3 day period where police were a little reticent to be getting right down in hunting for him effectively in his domain, in his countryside. And they were using other things to do that, right? They were using helicopters and drones and things like that to try and track him at that time. But it wasn't for a few days afterwards, people who were on the scene have told me that really intense kind of line by line searching through the bush for Freeman actually went on.
It intrigued me that Mike Bush, the Chief Commissioner of Victoria Police, said he thinks it's unlikely that Freeman was in the area, because at the beginning, in the early days, the popular theory was he had a pre-prepared bunker down an old mine shaft.
Yeah, look, there's so many theories about this, and that's what I found when I was up there, that everybody's got their own kind of explanation for what's happened. There is so many mine shafts there. In the kind of absence of any confirmed information, it's hard to know. But, you know, look, I think that there's no indication at all that this was planned by Freeman, that he knew police were coming, that he in any way had concocted this ambush. And, I mean, you know, there's obvious comparisons to be made with William Biller, but William Biller, there was a level of planning. There was a level of surveillance that people were doing on that property. There was a kind of ongoing, I guess, approach of gathering weapons and stockpiling ammunition and fear that police were going to come and get them. There's no indication that we have yet that Freeman knew these officers were coming. There's certainly indications that he didn't trust police and that he disliked police, but there's nothing that sort of goes to the fact that he knew they were coming, was planning some sort of ambush and could have prepared something like a bunker in the bush. But on the other hand, we know that he spent so much time up there. We know from people I've spoken to who used to be neighbours of his that he would just almost daily be traipsing up the mountain, spending hours up there at a time, and then traipsing down again. Was he potentially putting together some sort of bunker? Who knows? Because there is so little known about it, people are filling all those gaps in it with their own theories and speculation, and there's so little of it that can be disproven.
Coming up next, the flourishing conspiracy theories around the search for Desi Freeman.